Oliver Wendell Holmes was one of the most celebrated Supreme Court justices of the 20th century. But in his youth, he'd been a Civil War soldier. Holmes went to war as a young Harvard graduate, fired up with the hope of abolishing slavery. Yet, as with so many, the reality of war soon appalled him. He described one battle as
an infamous butchery and a ridiculous attempt.
He prayed he might lose a foot to avoid returning to combat. Caught up yet again in the sound and fury of battle, he feared for his sanity. And after the war was over, he refused to read about it or to observe its anniversaries. Oliver Wendell Holmes was typical of many Civil War veterans. Robert E. Lee, the South's greatest general, also shunned reunions and books, declining all lucrative offers to write his own memoirs.
I do not wish to awaken memories of the past.
In North and South, soldiers mostly got on with new lives. Relatively few of them actively participated in veterans' associations and reunions. Nor was there much public appetite for books or magazine articles about the war. Americans were moving on. The Civil War, it seemed, was dead and buried. Time, however, is a great healer, and also a great ager. As the young warriors turned grizzled and rheumatic, they began to look back with nostalgia. Again, Oliver Wendell Holmes was typical of many. In the 1880s, he grew again the curled military moustache of his youth. He brought out his uniform from a cupboard and placed his sword and regimental colours on display above his mantelpiece. In an age of comfort and commercialism, he began preaching the strenuous, heroic virtues of fighting for a cause. The annual ritual of Memorial Day, he told fellow veterans in 1884, was
the moment to recall what our country has done for each one of us, and to ask ourselves what we can do for the country in return.
These words would be echoed years later in John F. Kennedy's inaugural address. Holmes continued,
on this day, when we decorate their graves, the dead come back and live with us. And it is not of the dead alone that we think. The generation that carried on the war has been set apart by its experience. Through our great fortune, in our youth, our hearts were touched with fire. It was given to us to learn at the outset that life is a profound and passionate thing.
During the 1880s, commemoration of the Civil War really took off. The principal Northern Veterans Association was the Grand Army of the Republic, or GAR. In 1878, it had only 30,000 members. At its peak in 1890, the figure was nearly 430,000. Veterans didn't just visit graves and attend reunions. The GAR's local groups became a focus of community life in small towns across the North. And because of their size and organisation, veterans also became a formidable lobby group. Thanks to their pressure, in the 1890s, nearly a million veterans and their dependents were receiving government pensions, amounting to over 40% of the federal budget. And this in a country where any form of socialism remained anathema. Here was an early intimation of the power of the veterans' lobby in American life. There were other ways for veterans to make money from war service. One publication in Georgia included a picture of John Conway, a Northern soldier from Ohio, sitting on the ground with his knee bandaged. The text read,
I was wounded in the leg at the Battle of Stones River, December 31st, 1862. My blood was poisoned from the effects of the wound, and the leg swelled to double its natural size, and remained so for many years. The poison extended to my whole system, and I suffered 1,000 deaths. Nothing did me any good till I took Swift's specific, which took the poison out of my blood and enabled me to feel myself a man again. Swift's specific is the only remedy for blood poison.
War was now becoming memory and money. In 1913, it was decided to mark the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg, the turning point of the Civil War, with a week-long reunion of veterans from North and South. This calculated attempt at bridge building was meticulously planned. A huge tented city was erected across the battlefield, together with bakeries, kitchens, dining tents, washing facilities, water fountains, and other features of civilized life that hadn't been available during their first visit to Gettysburg in 1863. There was even a discreet stockpile of coffins in case some of the old men did not survive the excitement or the summer heat. Actually, only 9 veterans died out of an encampment of over 50,000. The reunion also attracted swarms of souvenir sellers and photographers, keen to make a killing, at least commercially. Philip Myers, an 18-year-old photographic assistant, recalled one northern veteran who wanted to be pictured in what was known as the Devil's Den, where the battle had been fiercest and where a southerner had shot him for real 50 years before. The northerner stood puffing on his cigar with one hand holding his cheek. When Myers protested that this spoiled the picture, the veteran explained,
"Well, I'm a-fighting and a-yelling at the top of my lungs when his bullet comes along and catches me right in my mouth. But what with yelling, my mouth is wide open. So it misses my teeth and comes out of my cheek. And when it heals, it don't close up tight. There's still a little hole there. If I don't plug it with my finger, I don't get no draft on my smoke."
He inhaled deeply and with lips pursed tight, blew the smoke out of his cheek. The climax of the reunion was a reenactment of Pickett's charge, that unforgettable Confederate assault across open fields into withering northern fire. Only half the 15,000 Southerners made it back to their lines that terrible day. Myers was among the thousands watching as the Southerners emerged from the woods just as they'd done 50 years before. Except that it wasn't quite the same.
"We could see not rifles and bayonets, but canes and crutches. We soon could distinguish the more agile ones, aiding those less able to maintain their places in the ranks. As the rebel yell broke out, after a half century of silence, a moan, a gigantic sigh, a gasp of unbelief rose from the onlookers. It was then that the Yankees, unable to restrain themselves longer, burst from behind the stone wall and flung themselves upon their former enemies. They fell upon each other, not in mortal combat, but reunited in brotherly love and affection."
Veterans and nation reunited. That was the official message from Gettysburg in 1913. And in the North, certainly, this was the predominant mood because the Civil War was no longer a live issue. But it's easy for victors to be magnanimous. In the South, an undercurrent of real bitterness remained. Many there lamented what was known as the Lost Cause, capital L, capital C. This took the line that we was robbed, they didn't play fair. In other words, the South went to war to defend states' rights against a centralizing government, the issue of slavery being quietly airbrushed out of the picture. The South, it was claimed, had braver soldiers and better generals, notably Robert E. Lee. But the North had more men and greater resources. Lee and his fellow officers were the epitome of nobility, whereas Northerners were immoral brutes, especially Sherman, who burned his way across Georgia. This was a struggle between Southern Cavaliers and Yankee Roundheads, backed by the clunking fist of industrial power. There was, too, a nostalgic belief that it might all have turned out differently. In William Faulkner's novel, Intruder in the Dust, published in 1948, he conjures up a mystical moment in history, suspended in time just before Pickett's charge.
"For every Southern boy, not once, but whenever he wants it, there is the instant when it's still not yet 2 o'clock on that July afternoon in 1863. The brigades are in position behind the rail fence, and it's all in the balance. It hasn't happened yet. It hasn't even begun yet. This time, maybe this time,
with all this much to lose and all this much to gain, Pennsylvania, Maryland, the world, the golden dome of Washington itself to crown with desperate and unbelievable victory, the desperate gamble.
The Lost Cause also moved from books and magazines onto the silver screen. Most of all, in the 1939 movie, Gone with the Wind. Based on the novel by Margaret Mitchell, which drew on stories she'd been told when growing up in Georgia. The film's opening scenes depict a land of colonnaded mansions and rolling acres, of cotton fields and magnolia blossom. The white women are elegant, their menfolk noble or at least dashing. And in the background, the black slaves are mostly dutiful and content, clearly incapable of looking after themselves. The Yankee juggernaut crashes through Georgia, bringing desolation to what had once been a land of grace and plenty. Gone with the Wind gained 10 Oscars, one of them awarded to Hattie McDaniel for her portrayal of the stereotypical black mammy. When the film had its gala premiere in Atlanta in 1939, McDaniel did not attend to avoid having to sit in the coloured section of the cinema. Her fellow actress, Butterfly McQueen, played another stereotype, the childish black slave. Malcolm X, the 1960s black radical, recalled seeing Gone with the Wind as a boy in Michigan.
I was the only Negro in the theater, and when Butterfly McQueen went into her act, I felt like crawling under the rug.
Audiences across America and all over the world flocked to see Gone with the Wind, which sold more tickets than any other movie in history. Much of its appeal, of course, was down to the screenplay and the acting, the sets and the music. But its depiction of the Old South, white and black, had a profound subliminal effect. The film was rooted in the ideology of the Lost Cause. It liberated its viewers from the burden of the South's real past, allowing an escape into flights of romantic nostalgia. But as the original book by Margaret Mitchell suggests, memories of the Civil War remained vivid and painful for generations of Southerners to come.
What was past. Those who were dead. The lazy luxury of the old days was gone, never to return. Throughout the South for 50 years, there would be bitter-eyed women who looked backward to dead times, to dead men, evoking memories that hurt and were futile, bearing poverty with bitter pride because they had those memories.